Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Cosmos Magazine, episode 3 of autumn 2017, and I'm going to try and podcast a gallery episode or article, and in this they have pictures, and they have here a picture of some sort of delta, and you can see the clouds from way above, and the clouds are pretty obviously, they cast a shadow so that you can see the sun's light hitting some of the little cumulonimbus clouds down the bottom, and all the way down you can see some sort of lake here. So I'm just going to this is a picture of Somalia in Africa, and let's read it to you. Quote, "The earth is art that a photographer is only witness," so said Jan Artus Bertrand, the French photojournalist famed for his creative career looking down on creation. "But to be witness akin to the world-renowned aerial snapper documenting the planet from above historically meant having to part with of a highly exclusive club, a membership as rarefied as the altitudes one needed to attain this perspective. But no longer. The chance to turn landscapes into landscape art is so limited, and no longer does it require commandeering a hot air balloon, aeroplane, or helicopter. Since 1996, a program sponsored by NASA has enabled school students around the world to remotely point and shoot special cameras on the International Space Station. Results are sometimes startlingly beautiful, less like glueable earth than a painter's canvas. Here are a few of the best selected by the art director Robin Aldery from the hundreds of images taken in a recent mission. Now, this is very interesting because it's a school. You now learn that these are taken by school children from the International Space Station. And here is a beautiful, it looks like a false color image. And you can see sort of dunes standing up against the blue. Color coding. While the purpose of imaging program is educational, the ordinarily vivid images that sometimes emerge demonstrate that art, like innovation, can be a creature of circumstance. In the case of Earth Cam, spelt E-A-R-T-H, capital K-A-M, the accidental artistry is amplified by the occasional color rendering befitting a florist a dream. Blues and yellows in this image might suggest drama and dynamism of coastland shoals, for example, but in fact, it's the middle of a dry desert. Here, the earthly hues depict waves of wind swept sand dunes, while the watery hues are also earth, an underlying tableau of clay and silt. Okay, this is a beautiful picture, and you can see the sand sitting on top. And false color, I do like false color. Now, this looks like a piece of marble. You can see the clouds from above, sitting above, and it's way, way ahead. So it's easily several hundred kilometres, 400 kilometres up, I believe. So you see a picture here. You see a river with a bit of green circular irrigation coming from it. Student power. The Celluride Earth Clam program is unique in giving students direct control of an instrument on a working spacecraft. Four times each year, the program provides a rare window of opportunity for students to request photographs of specific features or locations beneath the International Space Station's orbit. After the requests are processed and accepted by NASA's Space Center in Houston, an onboard computer handles the picture taken. Within hours of being taken, images are uploaded to the EarthCam website and made publicly available. Now approaching 60 missions, the program has engaged more than 500,000 students in 78 countries. Picture is South Africa, a bit for South Africa. And you can see down here. Okay, and here's another picture. You can see sand dunes. Oh, is that right? Yep. Okay. Now this is another. There's a little speckles and blue and sand. You can see bits of river beds and complexities. Sharing a vision. The program's full name, Celluride Earth Knowledge Acquired by Middle School Students program, is named after the first American woman in space, Celluride, pioneered in educational initiative First Class KidSat in 1985 as the space shuttle astronaut. "She was amazed by the view of our beautiful planet wrapped in this thin blanket of air," explained the colleague. And you can actually see it's such a thin blanket of air. Sally wanted to share the view with young people all over the world. The program, which was renamed EarthCam in 1998, is shifted to the ISS in 2001, was finally named in honour of Wright in 2013 following her death of pancreatic cancer. So that's what happened to Sally Ride. She died of pancreatic cancer, poor little thing. But I'll tell you what, there is a large amount of radiation you get up here. So if you get cancer on an international space flight, imagine what you get in a space station. So they do heaps of cancer tests on astronauts. Battle lines. So you can see here where agriculture has gone in one area and it's not in the other. While students learn about spaceflight, orbital paths, mapping, and weather by participating in the EarthCam program, perhaps it's these snapshots that teach the greatest lesson. From space, differences between nations and groups are rarely discernible, but others' fractures are starkly drawn. See nature's organic forms are subjugated to the geometric lines of human industry. The conquest is a graphical reminder. The planet is not terra firma, as the Mercury 7th astronaut Scott Carpenter once said. It's a delicate flower, and it must be cared for. Isn't it? And that's a picture of Australia. So you can see an area of intensely farmed land, and it goes to wilderness. Thank goodness we're out in the wilderness at the moment. Doesn't get... Oh, and that's the end of that one. So that was rather good. Now we're on to Jurassic Flight School. So this is episode 3, and it's the cover story. Fossil discoveries in China are rewriting history of flight, John Pickerel reports. Something found. So there's this bird with a bit of a tail and teeth, and it's like bat wings, it looks like. Okay, let's read about this, and you can see the actual fossil here. Oh, it's pretty. There's this thing that the bird fossils, when birds die and have a long neck, they throw their neck back. It's that common image that they die, and that's when they die that way, when they don't have enough oxygen, I understand. Since 1996, nearly 50 new feathered dinosaur species have emerged from the fossil fields of China. Paleontologists thought they had a good idea of the diversity of these fluffy carnivores, but recently, a recent finding has left them scratching their heads. Not as well written, I can't say. Not as well written as that Duffy article. Okay. The Shandong Tianyu Museum of Nature in Pingyi is a place to go if you want to experience Chinasaur's dinosaurs in all their weird and wonderful glory. Okay, 500 kilometres south of Beijing, it's the largest museum of its kind in the world, with fossils of more than 1,000 complete dinosaurs, 2,300 early birds, and plenty of creatures that bridge the boundary. Arranged in 28 halls in 3 nondescript-looking buildings. Oh, God, you can imagine this is a real mouse thing. These spectacular displays merely hint at the treasures behind the closed doors, where a backlog of new feathered dinosaurs finds it stacked up, waiting to be studied and named. Species described from the collection include the Tyrannoraptor, which resembles the Velociraptor, the Tenia-long, one of the first known feathered herbivores dinosaurs, already, and a four-winged dinosaur called the Antrolaurus and the Zaitinga. Many museums have single specimens of dinosaur species in their collections. Shandong often has several hundred. Quote, you don't need to do too much to dig up a fossil in China, the local paleontologist Wang Zaitol told the reporter in the New York Times. Quote, when the wind blows, they reveal themselves. Not much surprises the scientists and technicians who work in the geological riches that pass through these doors. But one fossil sold to the museum in 2007 has them stumped. Over the past 20 years, I've discovered many dinosaurs, so to a degree, I'm used to finding strange species, said Zhu Xing, the world's most prolific living dinosaur hunter. So, now, the interesting thing is that he means he's living rather than the dinosaurs. Just an aside there. Based at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology in Beijing, Zhu has been involved in the discovery and naming of approximately 60 dinosaur species, from the magpie-sized four-winged flyer Microraptor, found in 2000, to the giant 9-meter-long fluffy Tyrannosaurus Zootanus, named in 2012, but still, he says,
When I saw this particular discovery, I was shocked. Just when paleontologists thought they'd seen it all, this weird little fossil would reveal a bizarre experiment in the evolution of flight in dinosaurs, a process that gave rise to modern birds. Now, I've just got to remember, the dinosaurs went extinct 64 million years ago. The Permian extinction happened 250 million years ago. And then it's just, when did the dinosaurs rule? I think they ruled for approximately just over 10 million years from, more than 20, I think it's 12 million years. So I've just got to really work out what that means. But let's read about this. In the early 1990s, nobody could have predicted the incredible flurry of dinosaur discoveries that was about to begin in China. With the rebuilding of academic institutions after the Cultural Revolution and foreign-trained Chinese paleontologists returning home to prospect, China's Cretaceous and Jurassic-era rocks began to give up their riches. Something like 160 species of dinosaurs have been described across China since 1990, at the rate of new discoveries may not have peaked. It wasn't just a matter of numbers. The remarkable preservation of fossils from the northeastern China, particularly the provinces of Liang and Hebei, was unique too. One of the things recorded in exquisite details was feathers, the defining characteristics of birds. Most experts had come to accept birds were descendants of so-called pteropods, carnivorous dinosaurs such as the Velociraptor. Based on the similarity of the skeletons, bones filled with air pockets, wishbones, and many other features besides. And so wishbones is your sort of like a fused collarbone, which is a mechanical spring. So you've got the natural spring, say for kangaroo tails, which is in tendons. This is a spring in terms of keratin and cartilage in wishbone is a spring storage mechanism. This is an aside. But while the fossils of the archaic birds such as the Archaeopteryx, which flew with feathered wings but also had teeth and long bony tail, had been found as early as 1861, few thought we would ever find actual dinosaur fossils with feathers. That's why paleontologists were astounded when in 1996, a fluffy 1.5-meter-long dinosaur called Cynopteropteryx was found in Liang, near the border with North Korea. A region preserves a Pompeii-like world of dinosaurs in fine-grained sediments, including volcanic ash. So that would be interesting why that's happening. Sino, which means Chinese Auropteryx, feathers were not flight-worthy, however. They were short, downy fuzz visible on the head, back of the tail, and vividly preserved animal. Since that finding, we know that about 50 species of dinosaurs for which there is a direct evidence of feathers. Some are halos of fluff or beautiful fans of flight feathers delicately traced onto their remarkable fossils. Others have a distinctive Phaedo-style tailbone that would have been an attachment point for feathers. Still others have bumps along their forearm, quill knobs, where feathers attach to ligaments in the wings of modern birds. Most of the species come from the Chinese province of Liaoning, Inner Mongolia and Hebei, but a handful are from the nations of Mongolia, Burma, Madagascar, Germany, Canada and Russia. Madagascar is interesting. Together, the fossils show that most pteropod dinosaurs all over the world had feathers. While more than 90% of the fossil sites worldwide preserve only bones, Leon is a particularly preserves feathers and soft tissues. These unlikely fossils have given us a tiny window into the world we had no idea existed. We now have a remarkable evolutionary sequence of fossils from dinosaurs to birds. It shows how feathers evolved from very simple filamentation structures through to complex branched feathers, flight feathers, and also how flight itself might have developed. Cynopteropteryx, Downy's fuzz was probably used for insulation. In later models of dinosaurs, feathers began to be used for display. The massive Gigantoraptor, an 8-meter parrot-beaked omnivore found in the Gobi Desert in Inner Mongolia, for example, likely used great fans of tail feathers for mating displays. Only much later in the evolutionary process did feathers begin to be used for flight.
such as the four-winged pigeon-sized dinosaur, the Microraptor, found in 2000. Another four-winged fly, this is the wing that the front tails and the back, so they're just legs with feathers on them. Another four-winged fly, the eagle-sized Changioraptor, was discovered in 2014, and there are likely two of the others yet to be found. The wings on the hind limbs of the forelimbs of the animals help them glide between trees of China's Jurassic and Cretaceous forest. So Jurassic's after Jura, a place in Switzerland, the Jura area, and I think Jurassic's came ahead of the Cretaceous area. It's likely they were capable of full-powered flight and lacked the keel and sternum with large wing muscles anchored in today's birds. So it's unlikely, The four-wing model was one early experiment of flight within the group of animals from which birds evolved. Early birds would have large feathers on their hind limbs and feet too. Some chickens do today. I don't know whether you can actually link, you know, what that actually means. But it's interesting in terms of a group pushing into this niche. Yeah, it's interesting. It's not a linear push, but it's this force, this niche, and different animals go in and experiment. Apart from small dinosaurs, paleontologists were also surprised to discover much larger carnivores had feathers. A number of feathered Tyrannosaurus species were found in China, including Dilong in 2004, and the much larger Eutyrannus in 2012. This shaggy, 9-meter creature was much nearer the size of a T-Rex, making it plausible that the king itself had feathers. But there's Zhenhenyelong, a 2-meter-long dromaeosaur related to Velociraptor, described as fluffy-feathered poodle from hell. Found in 2015 in a 125-million-year-old deposit near Zhejiang Formation at Lyon, it is the largest feathered wings yet found on a dinosaur. So 125 gives you an idea of how old these were. Here's a picture. It's pretty amazing to see these things. Weird dinosaurs indeed, yet none of them were perplexing these specimen a zoo first examined in detail in 2009. At first, it was just an overall impression, but it would soon become clear the dinosaur was sporting features that surely didn't belong to the same animal. It's what the platypus of the dinosaur era. Many of the treasures that arrive at the Chengdong Museum have been dug up by farmers who supplement their meager income by excavating dinosaur remains and selling them to dealers and institutions. There you go. It's China. They would have, you know, a large population of people digging up dinosaur bones. In theory, it's been legal to buy fossils collected by such amateurs since 2008. But better that these priceless fossils are available for science, the paleontologists argue, than lost to the living rooms of wealthy private collectors. The majority of feathered dinosaur fossils have come from Liaoning, but some, such as the enigmatic specimen, are from the neighbouring province of Hebei. This relatively new locality for fossil hunters have been dated to the mid to late Jurassic. So Jurassic is before Cretaceous, and that's 160 to 165 million years ago. Fossils in northern, so really you really should do 165 to 160 because of counting back. So it's a bit confusing the way it's said. Quote, fossils in northern Hebei are not as rich as Liaoning, but often they are very well preserved. In some cases, feathers and soft tissues are even better preserved, says Zhu. One specimen was found by farmer Wang Jingyarong, who dug it from a fossil quarry near the village of Mutongding in Qinglong country. There, Hebei small mountains, deep valleys and rolling foothills are pocked with pits dug by fossil king farmers. Well, they're not really farmers, are they? Not their farms, they just happen to be out fossil hunting. Wang may not have realised what he found, something important, as the time the specimen arrived at Chengdong Museum, it was broken into several pieces and parts were missing. Good on ya. She first saw the strange specimen in 2009, shortly after it arrived in the museum. It was broken and partially covered with rock. He could tell this was a feathered dinosaur, but running his hands over it, he decided there was definitely something strange about it. In 2013, he sent his technician, Ding Zhou Wang Qing, to Shandong Museum and asked her to clean the overlying rock away. Several months of work later, Zhu could see the distinct skull shape and hand, and the hand that was Scansoriopterygid, climbing wings dinosaurs. The feathers grouped include the species of Expedidiopyrix and the Epididosaurus, previously called the Sansoriopterygix, I can't pronounce it, sorry guys, which have forward slanting teeth and weird fingers. Discovered in 2002 in Liaoning, Epididosaurus was thought to have been a sparrow-sized climb tree dweller with an elongated third finger that's possibly to skewer insects inside tree hollows, much as the AA lemur in Madagascar does today. So AA is a pretty amazing animal. The slightly larger picture size Tryx, I'm sure you can, found in Inner Mongolia in 2008, was weirder still. Like the Epididosaurus, it was covered with downy fuzz, but had four long, ribbon-like feathers emerging from its tail. Its third finger, appeared to obscure, may have been half as long again as its entire body. This was with other Sansoriopterygids, the feathers of the new creatures were simple, short, and brush-like. And that's really interesting to actually go into the modern way of feathers, like our modern feathers zip together. or it covered its whole body. Sansoriopterygids lacked large vein feathers and complex structures that are found in modern birds and many pteropod dinosaurs. Their feathers were known as dino fuzz and are more like the down on a chick, made of fluffy filaments with no central vein and complex branching structure found in what we typically think of as a feather. The more fuzzy feathers were preserved on another piece of fossil surrounding the part of the hind limb and foot. The analysis of the electron microscope revealed the presence here of melasomes, a tiny package of pigments responsible for the colours of feathers. So, some means an object, basically a bag. Melanin means colour bags. Further, as Ding slowly removed the matrix of rock encasing the follow, the experts noticed two rod-like structures near the wrist. They were nothing like they'd ever seen before. This confused us quite a long time, Sue says. It was apparently part of the skeletal system, but something we'd never seen in other dinosaurs. Zhu's colleague Gowen Sullivan first saw the fossil in early 2014 when he and Zhu and American paleontologist Jing Ma O'Connor were visiting the Shandong Museum. What really puzzled us, and so there's this picture of these birds with the really hooked claws. Okay, you've got the various pictures here, down to the four winged flies in the Late Jurassic. So, Late Jurassic is 160 to 145 million years. That goes correct. The smaller number is second. Now, Jurassic. Early Cretaceous is... Okay, Early Cretaceous is after the Jurassic. Okay. So, Late Jurassic is 160 to 145. Early Cretaceous is 145 to 100 million years ago. So, Cretaceous happens after, and you get your T-Rexes are in the Cretaceous, not Jurassic period. So that was a bit. Were these structures extending from both wrists that looked very much like the bones on the slab? But of course, pteropods aren't supposed to have bones in this position, he recalls. I remember standing around with Zhu, Jingma, and Zhang trying to work out whether these were ligaments or some other kind of soft tissues, but we couldn't come up with anything that really made sense. Later, humorous suggestions included they might have been used as giant chopsticks. And, of course, Sullivan happened to be working on a book with a section on gliding flying animals. A photo of a flying squirrel grabbed his attention. It showed the animal's styliform elements, rods of cartilage that protrude from the wrists of some gliding animals. These rods allowed them to hold their patanga, membranes of skin stretched from their wrists to their ankles, allowing them to fly. Okay, so this is not fingers, if you've actually got additional things. When I read about flying squirrels and the fossils just flashed into my mind, said Sullivan says. The idea was hugely exciting, but I reined myself in, thinking there's probably a dozen reasons this could be the same structure. As he began to research in more detail, however, he realized he was onto something. Modern birds do have, in fact, have a small flap, skin flap in front of the elbow called the protopatangium, which forms part of the wing, but is covered by much larger flight feathers. You can imagine part of the protopang is also preserved in the pteropod dinosaurs that are the ancestors of birds. And then what's going on in the sansauropterygoids is that it has expanded to form a wing membrane, Zhu says. Finally, we noticed there were patches of membrane preserved near the styriform elements. So styriforms are those pieces of cartilage. Suddenly realized we had a really bizarre dinosaur, a kind of pretosaur, which is like the pterodactyls, and not dinosaurs. They're flying things, but they're not dinosaurs. How do you like that? Or bat-like wings. We got so excited that we just couldn't believe what this had happened. Wings, in my mind, always had beautiful big flight feathers. These were major components of dinosaur wings, hence we had something totally different. Zoo realized that he had on his hands was a Jurassic equivalent of a platypus. Well, there you go. That's exactly what I was thinking. And the platypus evolved 130 million years ago. And, these are simply amazing. Yeah. Which stumped the 18th century British naturalist. Well, I think 19th century is more to it. Who first considered the stuffed specimen they received as fake. The new dinosaur had a feathered body, but wings made of skin flaps, resembling those of predators, distant cousins of dinosaurs that evolved independently. So they're not predators, are the pterodactyls, and they're cousins of dinosaurs. They're not actual dinosaurs themselves. Working with colleagues, including Sullivan, O'Connor, Zinglada, and based in China, University of Geosciences, Zhu began to amass evidence needed to back up their extraordinary find. Just as the 18th century naturalists, fake specimens have been a big problem in China, of course. In 1999, for instance, the National Geographic heralded the discovery of an Archaeoraptor as a missing link between dinosaurs and birds that turned out to be a skillfully glued together composite of a bird and dinosaur fossils. Zhu's expert eyes are rarely fooled, but he realized back-winged dinosaurs are so improbable, other paleontologists might have doubts. Before publishing Nature in May 2015, the team did a variety of analyses to prove, for example, that the fossilized styriform element had a chemical composition suggesting it originally had been made of bone or cartilage. Crucially, the experts knew it had not been glued together by a hoaxer. Zhu's own technicians had prepared the fossils out of a rock from the Zhaodong Museum. I'm 100% sure this is not a fake fossil, Zhu said. Sometimes I'm not so certain a fossil is real, or I think something may be wrong with it. But in this case, I'm quite certain. Furthermore, researchers were able to pin down Wang, the original discoverer, and visit the specific region within the quarry from which he'd extracted the specimen. To determine the geological layer and age, the team called the species Yinquai, pronounced Chi, Yi Chi, which means strange wing in Mandarin. The announcement of the species was greeted with a mixture of bemusement and palpable excitement by paleontologists' communities that had somewhat desensitized to the feathered dinosaur riches pouring from China. In an accompanying commentary also published in Nature, paleontologist Kevin Payden noted that the two decades since the Chinese finds were cemented had cemented notions about dinosaurian origin of birds. Quote, the picture of evolution of feathers and flight has come a richer and more complicated with the discovery. Similarly, a monthly basis of other feathered dinosaurs, but things have just gone from strange to bizarre. Daniel Kepser from the Bruce Museum in Connecticut similarly described the discovery as refreshingly weird, adding that paleontologists will be thinking of Jacques for a long time. It's probable that guiding membranes were present in all scansoriopterygoid dinosaurs. This explains their puzzling long fingers. They were not skewers for picking insects out, but trees, but struts on their membranous rings. Which I think is more logical. I tend to believe that Epidiopterix and Epididymosaurus both have wings, like Caesar. All members of the group probably had styrofoam elements and membranes attached. You need fossils to support this, but if you ask me, I believe it's possible. It's not clear what kind of flight mechanism the bat dinosaurs employed, but they may have used a mixture of gliding and flapping. Zhu's team attempted, without much luck, to make structural models based on fossils to assess them aerodynamically. Now they are creating three-dimensional computer models instead of that's what I would have done. You put it in a computer model. The expert and use artificial intelligence to do it. Reading the time. Okay. The experts also reappraised a handful of other sensoriopterygoid fossils in the light of what they know about the Z, but they haven't found direct evidence for a styrofoam element in the membranous wing. So this is a thick ridge of cartilage. Given that the scansoriopterygoids are so interesting and so bizarre, we want to do more work in this group, Zhu says. He plans to search for fossils in several localities in Inner Mongolia and Hebei. In 2016, Zhu told me his team carried out a study of the melanosomes. These are the colouring balls, a few parts of the fossils. I will say that Zhai Kui probably had a green or brown colour. It's my guess. Why would you say that? That's bizarre. He must have known something about it. It's a guess, but it's probably high because the melanosome structures appear similar in modern birds with green or brown feathers. If proven correct, this is the first time that green has been detected in a feathered dinosaur fossils. Or green or brown, if you ask me. The real big question is why this group evolved a second method of dinosaur flight when many closely related pteropod hunters had species with very large flight feathers. Well, probably the same reason that platypuses have evolved, because they've become isolated for some reason. The really big question is why this group evolved a second method. Okay. Quote, why evolve completely different flight mechanism and any body and body plan to Zoom? This is really bizarre, and so far I don't have a good answer. He believes that whatever big evolutionary transitions take place, such as that from terrestrial dinosaurs to flying birds, strange experiments take place to fill the new niche. That's my overall thing. There's a new niche, and things get going. So I don't know whether if you are an animal and you see things fly past, you might be tempted to jump off a tree yourself. I don't know what it means, or you can now fly up a tree and nest up a tree, it then means that you push other species up trees as well. I don't know. Some of the experiments may be recorded in the rocks of Hebei and Lingam. Ichi was totally unexpected. We wouldn't believe it. If you know dinosaurs very well and the transitions well, then you'd never expect there would be a dinosaur like a bat-like, a predator-like wings instead of feathered wings. Discoveries like this will continue to emerge and demonstrate how the complex transition from birds was, Zhu says. I would not be surprised if we find even more bizarre species in the future. I'm glad you're not surprised. Okay. In Papua New Guinea, the war on malaria hangs in the balance. Danger lies in the final stretch, Joe Chandler reports, putting the bite on malaria. Now, the poor New Guinea is actually diseased, ravaged. And so if you're the disease, they've got a huge disease load up there. So New Guinea is the island to the north of Australia. You go up to Queensland. Queensland's finished, then you get New Guinea. So New Guinea was actually a German colony protectorate before World War One. After World War One, it was ceded to Australia in 1975. We
gathered independence, but these, you know, cannibals, beautiful tribes, mountainous, extremely mountainous, and no sort of connecting river system in it, so everything's really fragmented. And the poor people have got so much disease. And malaria, I think, killed most of Captain Cook's crew on the way back. And he stopped at Timor. Oh, yuck. A mosquito. Now, in Australia, we have, from mosquitoes, dengue fever. They go up north. Not so much malaria now. And we've got something called Ross River fever, which people tend to get if they go canoeing out. Like Ross River fever, people pick it up if they go canoeing on the opposite side of the Blue Mountains. A night lands with a thud in the tropics, surrounding another round of inevitable hostilities. The fast-gathering gloom of the equatorial malarial country, community's most dangerous adversary, is on the move. So just to put you in a clue, for some reason, if you are... So if I've discovered I've been up in various jungles, there's the Kanungra School of Jungle Warfare. I think that would have to... That's such an icon of Australian infantry training. But in there, you sort of get used to it. Now, the edge of a forest in the jungle around a road becomes really hard to get through. So you get the impression that jungles are really hard to move through. And it is just slow moving through jungles. However, and it seems to rain. However, for some reason in the jungles, tropical jungles, night falls really quickly. Like it goes pitch black. You know, like here, I don't know. Well, firstly, it's on the equator or something like that. So, but the days of... that's just a knowledge that goes dark. So he's talking about the thud. Night comes to the thud. I sort of understand that. Let's read this here. The lowlands of Papua New Guinea's north coast have been the flashpoint for a shattering contrast of mosquito versus humans throughout history. And, yeah, the lowlands where the Japanese landed, they sort of landed over there. It was a big slog to push them out. Here, people don't so much die of malaria as endure it, the morbidity outstripping mortality. Dilapidating sickness reverberates through genetics, culture, and prosperity and aspiration. It's not as good a word because it's not using the idea of mosquitoes and stuff like that. It's a bit clunky, I believe, compared to what I've read before. It really does pull down. It's interesting they haven't got thalassemia there. Only in the past few years have locals dared to hope that it might not be ever thus, offering their blood and their children to research scientists who came to this front line in their quest to find a vaccine to prevent infection or better drugs to treat casualties. There's good reason for hope. Fighting malaria has been a global health success story. Since 2000, malaria incidence has fallen by 37% in populations at risk. Fatalities drop 60%. This means more than 6 million people's lives have been saved, most of them African children. Oh, poor PNG. So PNG stands for Papua New Guinea. So the island was divided. There's Papua at the top and then New Guinea at the bottom. So that's why it's called Papua New Guinea. It's sort of united between two things. Then Irian, which is owned by the Dutch East Indian, the other half of the island, the west half of the island, is Irian Jaya. But whatever it is, that was owned by the Dutch, and the Indonesians invaded it and took it over when they were getting independence. And Australians just hung back. There's been a few... I don't know, secret wars. You get stories of Australian troops mixing it with Indonesian troops up there, but it's not official history. PNG's control measures, in particular the rollout of long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets, have resulted in the prevalence of malaria declining by more than 80% across the country since 2009. Cases reported at four sentinel sites have dropped from 205 to 48
per thousand, surpassing all expectations. Isn't it amazing? I'll tell you what, army insect repellent doesn't, we call it funk off juice, but that's pretty amazing stuff. So an insect lands on it and dies. If an insect decides to go, and so I use that, I don't know how it works, but I had some fuck off juice and FOJ, and I had it and applied it to me when I went in with two Canadian rivers up in Ontario. I went with some Native American Indians and I applied some FOJ to myself, and all the little black flies and everything just landed and died, and I had to actually, it's almost like shaving off. So things are different. You've got to remember that. Okay. Encouraged by this success, PNG, in common with many other countries, have ramped up its ambitions of controlling malaria and eliminating it. It's an exciting time, but one tempered by risks of overconfidence and complacency, because we've never been here before. Global eradication began in the 50s, mainly using insecticides, had malaria eliminated in some locations and on the run in many places in the 1970s. But then the disease bounced back. Now the world again pursues what it hopes to be defining the end game against the disease. The lessons of the past weigh heavily. Yeah, I sort of know a bit like that. And there's, if can I say, there is such corruption in Australia and up there. The greatest lessons of all is that the fight against malaria cannot be won by shock and awe campaign, but through a comprehensive hearts and mind campaign aligned with the dogged jungle warfare. Oh, God. At the vanguard of the battle, the field teams in Papua New Guinea's Institute of Medical Research, PNGMEA, they trawl through the lowlands of Bandang and Sepik provinces for morsels of intelligence required to further advance the assault on malaria, working alongside locals and enlisting vial swabs, needle slides, and stories of observational communities. The teams are defining a textbook model of grassroots research required for the long march to eradication. No corner of our understanding of malaria today is untouched by the research findings from Papua New Guinea, says John Reeder, a former director of PNGMEA, who now heads the World Health Organization's Special Program for Research and Training for Tropical Diseases. At the time of the Institute's 40th anniversary last year, quote, while some other parts of the world were subject to commando research, the PNGM program was built on a solid foundation of community participation. And can I say, the communities up there are both beautiful and complex, like bizarrely complex. So a lot of my friends have been up there on various, humanitarian mapping missions, and they just have stories which will astound you. I might tell them on stage. Leanne Robinson's regular morning begins on a fractured road of downtown Mentane, a sweltering gridlock of battered buses and trucks piled with peoples and cargoes. The port town was once said to be the prettiest in the Pacific, and there are still glimpses of that place. War, neglect, industry, and exploding populations have dulled its charms, but not its potential as a strategic hub for desperately needed trade, research, investments. Oh, okay, I wouldn't mind seeing that. Driving from Mandang to the laboratories of PNGMI, about 10 kilometres south, takes Robinson to some more postcard tropical idyll, though through tangled, lush forest, past palm-thatched hamlets. She has driven this route most working days of the past 8 years, navigating around chickens, children, potholes, and the old creek crossing. She definitely works the gears of her four-wheel drive. And I must admit that there is something, if you go up to the tropics and the Queensland drivers, it's just amazing to see how they can just, I'd stall everything. And the way that they actually take tracks. And so some tracks you would think you'd go really slowly, they just go hell for leather because they go fast enough that the four-wheel drive skips on the top ridges. Okay, locals wave her along. Many know her sight. Those who don't know where she's from, Okay. One way or another, they're all touched by the programs he oversees. Robinson has been head of the Institute of Vector-Borne Diseases Unit since 2013. That's really good. Vector-borne. Infections carried by mosquitoes are her business. And this stretch of country is a mossy paradise. It's beginning to come together a bit more with this article, but it's still a bit grating. Malaria is particularly and powerfully entrenched in communities here on PNG's north coast through the surrounding lowlands, where it has afflicted and shaped generations throughout history, a story written in their DNA. Despite the gains of the past 15 years, malaria continues to have a heavy toll through PNG. Nearly 95% of the population lives in an area where malaria is high risk, with more than 1 million presumed confirmed cases in 2013, most recently in which figures are available from the Asia-Pacific Malaria Elimination Network. So it's APMEN. Countless more go undiagnosed and untreated. This represents the highest malarial burden of the Western Pacific region and amongst the highest burdens outside Africa. But the fixes applied to Africa won't always work in PNG, which hosts a different suite of mosquito species and parasites. Different parasites, there you go. Not all mosquitoes transmit malaria. The culprits are certain species of the genus Anopheles. The unwitting air transport service enlisted by the diabolical biological passenger Plasmodium. And that is pretty amazing how that lives. It's got a cycle which is all of its own. There are four main types of human malaria. By far the most notorious is the deadly Plasmodium falciparum, the biggest killer globally. The biggest killer globally, and the main strain in sub-South Africa. By contrast, PNG has the world's highest prevalence of P. vivax, which is difficult to control because it lingers in the body and relapses. PNG is host to low undercurrents of P. voli, also relapsing, and P. malaria. So there's falciparum, vivax, ovalium, so you go back to it. So it's something that you can't get rid of. Now, P. ovalium sounds like eggs. It's malaria. So malaria means bad air. So originally, that's what it means. Originally, people thought malaria was from bad air. And some of the great people who've died from it is Alexander the Great was one of them. And Oliver Cromwell. Now, Oliver Cromwell was offered the... quinine. But when he heard that quinine was developed by Jesuits, he refused it. This is all part of the malaria story. The quinine story is just fascinating. And I can't say the Germans developed artificial quinine, and the Americans sent a special forces unit to capture him. I think it was in a book. This is a sort of a boy's own war story, and that helped America build artificial quinine. Is this true? I think it is. I really seriously didn't care whether it's true, because I was never going to podcast. I didn't care. I was just reading through. But there is truth about the Germans making artificial quinine, the Americans stealing it, and the Americans needed quinine in their troops to go in. So I think it's more that they can put, and it's still, the Americans got really destroyed by the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal really was really a malaria death spot for them, so they sort of learnt about that, and also learnt from the Philippines the malaria toll. So it's a pretty interesting story. So malaria is a key factor in World War II. So the fact that the Japanese took Indonesia, cut off our quinine supply, and there's a whole lot of politics about how the Dutch had better quinine trees by outsmarting the British, and so the India had low producing quinine trees for the classic gin and tonic. Being malaria in PNG therefore requires a bespoke campaign. Okay, so you've got all these four different types of malaria, some relapsing, An abandoned rural area requires a bespoke campaign and tools and tactics. Identify and trialing and tracking is effective countermeasures. So this is bloody complex. Has been a preoccupation of scientists and researchers of the PNGMR through 40 years history. The Institute's work is funded by the PNG and Australian governments, as well as grants from worldwide collection of international NGOs. The Institute helps form a national strategy that makes encouraging progress across the country. Intensive control efforts have slashed the number of annual deaths from 20,000 to 3,000, about 300 today. Rates of sickness, however, remain high, and it's common that the same person is infected by multiple times. They suffer terrible headache, nausea, shaking chills, raging fever, fatigue, body ache. The toll on children's health and education and still households when parents get sick is shattering. The debilitating disease is a major health and economic burden in the country. Yeah, I can just tell you that it's actually very difficult being sick and you're poor at the same time. It's just really hard. Man in questions remain about the local malarial parasite's persistence and idiosyncrasies. What is the particular strain here makes it more likely for children to get sick and die? How can the cycle of infection and reinfection be broken? Is there other enigmas, questions preoccupying Robinson and her team? Robinson pulls up in the shade near a constellation of weary shacks. I love that constellation of weary shacks. That house the PNGMR laboratories. Mouldering in the tropical heat, but functional, jammed to a sagging rafters with equipment. Personnel and archives and the facilities are stoic testimonies to the resolve researchers who have worked here since the lab was built in 77. Over those years, they have had some remarkable achievements. They include conducting in 1985 one of the first field trials of insecticide-treated mosquito nets, now a critical tool in the global anti-malarial arsenal. One point they have even came tantalizing close to realizing the dream of a vaccine, progressing to field trials of a therapy that ultimately proved unsuccessful. An effective vaccine for the dominant strain of malaria in the part of the world, P. virax, has so far eluded everyone. The most promising vaccine to date, RTS-S, now undergoing testing in pilots in Africa and targets P. falciparum, whatever it is, the first one, so it doesn't work against the parasites most widespread in the Asia Pacific. Robinson and her colleagues continue the tradition of a long line of scientists who have come to the coast determined to make some contribution in beating disease. It was the scourge of German colonists, so it was, you know, the Germans came over here, came over there first. In 1899, they imported their celebrated countryman Robert Koch, which is, you know, very famous, a scientist who unveiled the tuberculosis vaccine, its bacteria, and some years earlier, to try to find some solution to malaria. Despite 2 years' work, it defeated him. I don't know whether it actually killed him. In 1977, other storied scientists have arrived in Mandung. Australian researcher Michael Alpers had already spent years working in remote areas of the country, playing the central part in cracking the baffling killer Kuru disease. Okay, so Kuru is a pyron disease, because the pyron disease, prion disease, so this is where you have a protein which when it goes back to protein folder, it changes the protein folder so that the protein folder now folds copies of the prion. So it's it's the same protein, but it's misfolded. And my father was very much involved in the Kuru or laughing sickness. So what happened is that people would eat the brains of people. Now, this is a really interesting thing, is that they discovered it was brains, but then they said cook the brains, and then the disease went away, and then they realised afterwards that cooking the brains doesn't destroy the prion. It's like cooking hamburgers. It's like the cure is similar to mad cow disease, but not mad cows. You eat people that you kill, and killing people was not so aggressive. It was sort of more a spiritual thing, a more social thing. So
the men got to eat the brains, and of course the men got the disease, and so it tended to indicate would be family dominant families would be the dominant ones who have fed the brains first, and so they would have kuru. So the kuru had a definite genetic family tree fingerprint, and going back, and of course this is so much, and the actual statistician, which is Sir Ronald Fisher, who was looking at it in the early 60s. He came out to Australia as a immigrant, a very famous person, Sir Ronald Fisher. Statistician. He was also a white supremacist. So this all came together, and so my father, a seer of sorrow, undid it. But in general, kuru disappeared when people stopped eating people, I think is the major thing.
Okay. Now, taking up the position as director of the fledgling, so what's it, when did she come out? 77. So, yeah, that would be about right. Taking up, so he would have been CSIRO. He set to work immediately to make Mandan a permanent field headquarters of the research mission, recruiting specialists, scrounging funds, and negotiating to set up shop in a cluster of disused buildings at the Bush Hospital in nearby village of Yanganom. APA's research also went on to hunt for other strategies and interventions that might curtail, even squash the spread of disease. By their experience had taught them about the resilience of their foe. Almost a decade had passed since the massive insecticide spraying of DDT, the weapon of choice in the First World Malaria, the Global Malaria Eradication Program, 55-69, rolled out across PNG and the rest of the world.
So this is massive, massive pumping of DDT, and of course this builds up in the environment and kills the fish and knocks out kidneys and all that type of stuff.
Despite being successful in many locations internationally, for a complex mess of reasons, the program was abandoned. It couldn't work as a lone strategy in less developed nations. Funding fell short. So
I think that really worked in South America, for instance, that they, I don't know, had different training of people. So I do know people working up in Papua New Guinea. It was the concept of, like, if you train someone after a year, they'd do it, but after 5 years, they'd be doing something completely different and ineffective. It was, I'm not saying anything against Papua New Guinea, but the people I know who are up there, there's just not the same idea of the way of doing things. It means that the way they do things change, and they find new ways of doing it, but for when you have a technological solution, it's a problem.
Malaria bounced back with vengeance in many countries, including PNG, where the elimination campaign had reached about 70% of the population by the early 70s. The moral of the story, there can be no weakening of efforts against malaria. As the World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan warned in 2015, the launch of the WHO UNICEF report on the success of anti-malarial programs since 2000. With a disease like malaria, you can never tread water. You either surge ahead or sink. That year, Papua New Guinea signed on to the efforts to eliminate malaria in the Pacific Asia region by 2030. It's a big shift in the mindset of a country and decision makers that elimination is even on the agenda, Robertson says. But the welcome ambition is not without its hazards. The risk of committing to such an ambitious goal is the potential that attention is diverted away from the need to maintain control, and that the worst thing that could possibly happen, because we will backslide to square one.
Now, the other thing is that there's, mineral deficiencies. There's, particularly in New Guinea, there's iodine deficiency, which is cretinism. There's AIDS. There's things which, instability, you have riots, whole thing. It's just an incredibly mad place.
Complicating the campaign and adding to its urgency, it's concerned around increasing resistance to artesamalin, a powerful, effective component of many treatment drugs. It has already been confirmed that 5 countries in Southeast Asia, and there is a real risk that the strength of the disease resistance to the most available anti-malarial medicines will soon emerge elsewhere in the region. The challenge for Robinson and her colleagues now is to generate more insights and tools to stay one step ahead of this wildly masterful survivor, the Paralysodium. It is an incredible, incredible, incredible disease. I find it really fascinating. And also the way that it's got a life cycle inside the insect. The other thing is, I think few people really understand how mosquitoes draw blood. So their little pincer, the main thing, there's actually jaws on the end of their pincer, and there's several tubes which deliver lubricant and anticoagulant. And when they don't pin by actually sticking their thing in, they actually munch their way in through cells. It's pretty amazing to see it. Know the enemy and know yourself is often quoted a rule of war that reflects, which is something Sun Tzu, reflects the core research efforts in Pygmy Laboratories and its Firefine field satellites sites. The strain of malaria which looms the most dangerous is PNG is P. vivax. It has too often been overlooked and underestimated in malaria research efforts because it's less deadly than P. falciparum, but debilitating sickness has a shattering and enduring impact on individuals and communities when the victims can't work or go to school or care for the families. And of course, in a poor community, taking a sickie is devastating. The powerful tricks of vivax and other local players of area is the ability to lurk dormant in the liver of human hosts. Over the ages, these parasites have ensconced themselves as a liver stage hypnozoites deep in the collective body of the population of the North, because the PNG, carried about and nurtured by often healthy, unwitting men and women and children, the enemy within. Sometimes hypnozoites rouse to inflict relapsing illness in their characters. This is a malarial tale familiar to many travellers and soldiers who return from the tropics to find themselves mysteriously floored with bouts of illness for years afterwards. Often the hypnozoites lurk entirely under the radar. Individuals host them rarely, and if ever, experience any classic symptoms of malaria. Hypnozoites do not show itself on any present available diagnostic blood test, which I think they are dormant little things. Whatever you could do, you could find them out with obviously liver biopsies, but with ultrasound. Even when they awaken, the infection in the blood can sometimes lie low, produce few, if any, symptoms, and be difficult to detect by standard methods. But, explains Robson, if you screen people with something more sensitive, you often find they come up positive and potentially have a parasite stage that's transmissible back to the mosquito. That's what you want to do. Oh, here's the malaria life cycle. Okay. I'll just read this and then just try and go through it, because it's got cysts and different things going on. Cyst is basically a thing where the body isolates it and actually winds up feeding it. It's pretty amazing. Once inside the human host, the parasite resides in the bloodstream, rides the bloodstream to the liver and pushes its way into liver cells. It digs in and multiplies, copying the DNA over and over. A single infected liver cell can host thousands of newly hatched parasites modified to target red blood cells. After the parasites enter the red blood cell, it continues. So it rides in the bloodstream, goes to the liver, and then it multiplies inside the liver and then bursts to attack the red blood cells. The red blood cells don't have DNA. It's an interesting thing. After the parasites enter the blood cells, it continues to multiply while hiding out within the body's immune system. Eventually, the affected cell bursts and more several parasites are released into the blood cell. It's about now the human host might begin to feel sick. Without treatment, depending on the strain of parasite, the host's health and age level required immunity, she or she may be suffering from anything from mild fever to overwhelming sickness and blood loss, convulsions, brain damage, coma, and death. Pregnant women and children under the age of 5 are most vulnerable. Okay, so the mosquito injects it, goes to the liver. Once in the liver, it goes into a cell. Now it says, parasite infects liver cells. The parasite can lie dormant as a hypnozoite. Liver cell relates metrozytes, which target red blood cells. Ruptured red blood cells release more metrozytes, which infect more blood cells in the cycle that can produce 10 to 13 parasites. So that's 10 trillion parasites. Okay. Some metrozytes become gametes of 6 cells. Transmitted mosquito human blood cells are sucked into the mosquito's stomach. So you're not so much... It's one of the most important things is that you're not... The mosquito nets are not... This is just strange. They're not necessarily protecting humans from malaria. They're protecting the mosquito malarias from inside. Now, it's got to suck in a male and female cell, it says here. 6 cells form a cyst inside the mosquito, alright? So they reproduce, have a 6 cell inside the mosquito. The cyst ruptures and in the salivary gland of the mosquito. So they go, the cyst develops in the salivary gland. So they have 6 inside the mosquito, it goes in the salivary gland, and then it reinfects the humans. So that's an interesting thing. Now let's see how we're going for time here, mate. Okay, I'm going. Wow, this is a big article, mate. If an uninfected mosquito feeds on a Parasitidium-infected human, the parasite might seize the opportunity to climb aboard the mosquito. When the now-infected mosquito takes a meal of human blood, the injecting saliva down to its meal to stop it clotting, the parasite slides in as well. So when the now-infected mosquito takes the next meal of human blood, injecting saliva down to the meal to stop it clotting, the parasite slides in as well. I don't know exactly what it means there. I think it's in the blood. The system makes for a kind of parasite magic pudding. The blood running into the veins of the human populations as endemic malaria country serves as a replenishing reservoir of the parasite. Tackling this, Robinson said, is a major challenge. So insect nets stop people reinfecting the mosquitoes. Robinson has led an investigation of the landmark 2015 study that revealed 4 out of 5 cases of PVAX malaria infections, at least 3 out of every 5 POV cases in children come from relapses rather than fresh bites. So it's... That is interesting. So it's gone for the main thing. Then one of the things is that the... So there's a point where it puts... What is it called? The sporozoites. The sporozoites... come out and then they get reinfected. So that's interesting. It's a cycle. Okay. Okay. The study provided critical insight to the dynamics of the disease and what to take to get on top of it. Interrupting the transition cycle, the researchers concluded, requires mass treatment campaigns, kind of blood and liver stage treatments. Whatever measures might be taken to eliminate the control of the parasite spread in the outside world, bed nets and insect spraying, would be undermined as long as the parasite could revive itself in the liver stage. Capacity to roll out treatments that can knock the parasite out of the liver is hampered by the limitations around available drugs. It's really interesting because the liver is a cleaning thing, so your liver tends to break down drugs going to it. So that's why hepatitis is all that hard. Right now, the only drug licensed to clear hepatocyte liver is primaquine. So it's not quinine, but primaquine. But for individuals who lack a gene that is important for the normal red blood cells function, primaquine can be toxic. So patients need to be carefully screened and monitored. Finding ways to overcome these obstacles is just what it's, I mean, it's toxic for people with whatever it is, thalassemia, I suppose. Finding ways to overcome these obstacles is just one of the broad sweep of investigations underway at PNGMO laboratories, drawing on work across a large range of communities and field sites, many of them enlisting cohorts of hundreds, sometimes thousands of local people. For me, understanding malaria and the ways we might possibly intervene against malaria is about the people, Robertson says. Working closely with communities to identify who's infected, who's most at risk, and how that's changing. Understanding dynamic interplay between host, parasite, and vector, so that we could know what interventions will be effective and have a sustained impact. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, to be brutal there, I just think you want to extract people from the area which have the infection. That's the only way you can do it. So you move uninfected people to one area and infected people to the other. So cancel the deck chairs, and then in the unaffected area, screen it of mosquitoes, and then just sufficiently move it on. So if you've got an unaffected, I've got a method I can think of doing it. One of the communities where Robertson, her institute colleagues, and their international partners have been engaged for the past decade, collecting intelligence and blood samples and rolling out trials, is the old mission settlement of Mugli, about an hour's rough driving north of Mangan up the coastline to the Bismarck Sea. The Germans. She parks her four-wheel drive under the trees of the busy health centre, where about 2,000 people, mostly heavily pregnant women and women with young babies, wait to turn to see the nurse. Robinson chats easily, mother to mother, in a mix of English and pigeon talk. In something, it says Creole, it's really interesting the language there. They learnt washing machine is a machine. So they used to call cars washing machines. Sky washing machine would be a helicopter. It's something of a treat these days for Robertson to get out of the office, but she plainly revels in the fieldwork, connecting easily and warm with locals. Seduced by the global health during a stint volunteering at Ghana, when she first came to BNG a decade ago, as a 27-year-old doing field work for her PhD malaria immunology at the Melbourne's Walter and Eliza Institute, Wayham. She lived for months at a stretch in one of PNG Zimmer's field outposts at Mapique in eastern Sepik province, north of Mandaim, famous for its wild rivers, crocodiles, carvings, culture, and off-the-chart malarial rates. I love that. Blah, blah, blah. And off-the-chart malarial rates. Her interest in studying the natural immune responses of children living in endemic malaria zones, her research drew on samples of data collectively by PNG MR teams. Having fallen a bit in love with the PNG, she leapt on the opportunity in 2009 to work with the Institute full-time. Initially on secondment from Walter and Eliza Hall, and these days working in affiliation with the Burnett Institute, another Australian, also based in Melbourne. When she and her husband made the move to Mandaing, they planned to stay for 2 years, but they have stayed for 8 years and had two babies of their own. Oh, isn't that sweet? Oh, my God. Through the Mulgi facilities attired, they are better resourced and staff than many other PNG. In a tiny room tucked under the wide veranda, Sister Mary Slalib examines the miserable-looking 7-year-old boy brought to her clinic by his mother because he has skinny hat fever. Although based at the health centre and pitching on general's duties, Salib is also a PNG ML prayer attending to any patient suspected of having malaria. She pricks the boy's fingers and squeezes a drop of blood into a white dipstick. A few minutes later, a rapid diagnostic test, which has been revolution malaria treatment in recent years, come up with a positive pre-vax malaria. How the heck? Isn't it amazing that they can do that? So I went to hospital and they said, have you got diabetes? And before I could get a real answer, they said, no, you don't. The test was that quick. And then they did another test. And before I could complete the conversation, they'd done the test. So it explains the boy's mother, he's still given amiodarone tablets and precomines, PN's first-line standard treatment of uncomplicated malaria, and she'll begin to feel much better within a week or so. Sickness, though, might linger for a month. It's severity compounded by common factors like sepsis, bacterial meningitis, and, most significantly, malnutrition. But so the malnutrition in Papua New Guinea is due to, it can be due to soil types or diet. Sally also works through consent protocol with the boy's mother to enroll him in one of the ongoing studies to be conducted at Melgar near the range, from the routine surveillance to long-haul tracking of children's of children. With this information, Robinson and her early colleagues see in Australia what would happen is that one person would come out with malaria and they would then do the whole population. Okay, so I think if there was a malaria outbreak in Australia, it would be treated as, I don't know. Okay, Robinson and her colleagues can begin to untangle questions around the children's immunity as well as the activity of the various parasites in PNG, one which are active in locations and what sicknesses in addition to malaria they are causing. So just a leaf out of the book, they would perhaps, instruction in this article is structured in a particular way, it's got so much information and they've lifted it a certain way and they're going to ramp it through. What may well happen is that someone writing this would start off with the Malaria Institute and they prick the blood, put a bit of information in, what's it called, blood test. All the blood tests are going to be really quick and it's really important, blah, 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 and they'd bring that theme through. Nationwide, there has been a progressive decline in the prevalence of both Parasitium falciparum, PFAX. Robinson says this, but the story varies between different parts of the country and it's dynamic. Inland, transmission has declined and stayed low, with bed nets having made a big impact on reducing cases. But coastal areas and lowlands, like Manang province, the suspicion is that rates have popped back a little bit. Whether this is indeed happening, and if so, whether these are new infections or coming out of the Hypnozoite Reservoir, will soon be the subject of a major investigation by Robin's and her colleagues Moses Lamman, who is a central role in the suite of international studies now underway. Lamman, a pediatrician turned researcher, is himself a survivor of severe malaria contracted as a child growing up in the Septic River. His research has tried to unpick some of the intriguing genetic factors that play malaria scenarios in PNG. There are lots of evidence in the literature that the mortality of Melanesian children with severe malaria is lower. So these are not the Papuan, there's Polynesian, Melanesia, and the Papua New Guinea populations are separate. Lemon Works investigates why they get the disease and they don't die like African children. One of the key projects of the Miracle Centre investigates the potential of kicking the tail of the successfully preventing malaria in children aged under 5. Historically, the cohort most likely to die. The current hypothesis is that as exposure to malaria parasites become less frequent, children don't develop strong protective immune responses when they are very young, which means they become sick as older children or adolescents. Quote, so we need to consider that in the next 10 years, the vulnerable age group might shift upwards, Robinson says, and what impact will this have in terms of transmission and control? I'll tell you what. And what's it? Different malaria, different. I know people who can tell a species of malaria, a mosquito, by the actual buzz. And there's a Wallaroo State Forest around here, and it has the Wallaroo State Grey, and State Forest Grey, and you think it's a kangaroo, but they say no, it's the mosquito, and they come in and you can see them against the night sky coming in. It's like this disaster. Okay. To defeat malaria requires capturing not just human data but the enemy. Okay, I hope I'll get to that. To that end, the PMG deploys some creative and sometimes crude, albeit effective, strategies. An example is a human landing catch. Valiant teams and researchers are sent into villages at dusk. They bare their ankles, tantalising mosquitoes. When the insects land, the trick is to suck them in up with lengths of plastic and imprison them in vials before they take their meal. Oh my God, Father! Another technique is to, well, surely you use fuck off juice. Okay. Another technique is to hoist plastic barriers up on stilts to catch passing mosquito traffics. This provides the Institute's entomology laboratory with specimens that have already been satiated by their thirst of blood. That blood meal is analysed, yielding the insight into which creatures, human or pig or otherwise, are referred by different species. Surveyors also compose data sheets of mosquito behaviour. There is evidence that some species are evolving countermeasures to bed nets. Denied access to warm sleeping bodies, they change their strategy. Late night biters strike earlier. Indoor biters feed outdoors. The gift for adaptation, the secret of Anopheles mosquito's superlative evolutionary performance, will have profound implications for the control measures into the future.
Yeah, I think there was this major thing. I think the Japanese knew when they were invading the places when the mosquitoes came out and what to look for.
Overseeing the cornucopia of programs makes for a richly rewarding scientific life, Robertson says. While some researchers long-haul, other programs can have immediate translation to impact on the ground. For instance, earlier IMR work investigating and demonstrating the efficacy of new anti-malarial drugs underwrote the shift to anthrometer and leframine as an effective first line of treatment. The new trials of new prevention regimes in pregnancy and infancy substantially improve the health of mothers and babies involved, reinforcing the policy of intermittent preventive treatment for malaria during pregnancy. That is, giving pregnant women a full course of anti-malarial medicine at routine antenatal checkups, whether the woman had malaria or not. Suffer, you babies. It wouldn't come in here. Currently, the Institute is running a world-first trial of a novel drug regime for the control of elimination of another disease spread by mosquitoes, lymphatic filariasis, commonly known as elephantiasis. This neglected tropical disease impairs the lymphatic system and leads to gross swelling, debilitating disability and stigma as the elephant disease. This trial is set to change WHO's policy and accelerate elimination of the disease worldwide. Robinson is passionate about nurturing homegrown talent. One of the most rewarding parts of being here is the length of time is being able to see people go from being clinicians to science graduates straight out of university, coming to research for the first time, learning how to research is done, getting a PhD, coming back, experiencing an independent researcher, seeing thesis. Okay, I might be able to get back. This is a marathon article, don't you think? It's been going for an hour and 20 minutes. We're seeing the development of a cohort of Papua New Guineans in the leadership positions in this institute, addressing the questions that are really important to PNG, and that is an incredibly satisfying difference to when I arrived in 2009. That PNG and its people have taught Robinson, she says, is immeasurable, what they have. Quote, when I came here, I was focused on research questions I was wanting to ask, the projects I was working on, and probably a narrow and fairly naive view of how that work fitted into the overall context of malaria and PNG, and even globally, she says. And look, I have to say, look, I agree with this. I'm doing research, but I'm really aware that I'm also engaged in sort of an anthropology, Australian anthropology, trying to work out the Australian hatred of science. It's amazing. She also learnt how to communicate science and negotiate informed consent with teams operating in 70 languages in a vastly different cultural system. So there are 700 languages which are unique. Okay, they're a linguist's dream, but they're not from, they don't have a root system. They appear to be unique. To locate individuals in far-flung villages, to reconcile the ritual demands of modern medicine with the ancient superstitions and not run afoul of complex local politics. And not least, how to pilot a four-wheel drive across rivers, mountains and broken roads.
So that ends an hour and 23 minutes of reading. Thanks a lot for listening. Malaria, isn't it fascinating? I'm really glad I read about this. Thanks a lot for listening. Thank you.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.